Again, a visit to Corinth. I wonder today how good we are at reading the signs. I'm not talking about traffic signs. I'm not talking about signs at the supermarket, but rather the sign of the times. How good are you seeing things begin to develop and being able to deduce the inevitable outcome of the signs you are seeing? I'm not talking either about apocalyptic signs today, not at all. I ran across a list of some signs that should you see them, you know you're in for a very bad day. Some examples of the signs listed there are as follows. You receive a phone call from the producers of the Dr. Phil show asking if you would like to appear on the show with your spouse. That's going to be a bad day. Another surefire bad day sign is you show up at work and the television crew from CBC News is camped out in the lobby of where you work. Another bad sign is you turn on your television and they're showing the quickest ways to evacuate the city. This is for Wendy, wherever Wendy, oh, Wendy's right, this is for you, Wendy. You know you're going to have a bad day when your twin sister forgets your birthday. You know it's going to be a bad day when you arrive at work and your boss tells you not to bother to take off your coat. Oh, it's a really bad day. If you find out that your check to Revenue Canada bounces, that's a bad day. It's a really bad day if you're driving along and your car horn goes off accidentally and it remains on blaring all the way as you follow a group of Hell's Angels bikers down the highway. You know it's a really bad day when your daughter's new boyfriend arrives at your home wearing a tracking bracelet on his ankle. Now, I know you could probably think of all kinds of other examples of knowing or signs that are showing you you're going to have a bad day. And one bad day is enough, isn't it? But what do you do when you've experienced a few bad days in a row? It's tempting to just throw in the towel, isn't it? To walk away, to give up. Warren Wiersbe has a book out called Be Daring. It's been out for a number of years now. He tells the story of a man who was out shoveling the snow in his driveway. We know what that's like. It had been a heavy snowfall. He was about halfway through digging out his driveway when two young men approached him, both carrying shovels. And one of the young men said, "Can we shovel your snow, mister? Only $2. Puzzled by the question, the man replied, "Can't you see that I'm doing it myself and I'm already halfway finished?" "Sure," the one lad said. "That's why we asked. We get most of our business from asking people who are halfway through and want to just quit and give up." Do you ever feel like quitting? Giving up? You ever feel like quitting your job? Quitting your marriage? Quitting your church? Dare I say, perhaps even quitting your own life? I think we can agree that nothing is more harmful to the human condition than discouragement. We've talked a lot about that over the last few years. What I want to tell you today is that we will miss something very vital in the book of Acts if we don't see that the Apostle Paul was someone who was also prone and also struggled with discouragement. We will do Paul and ourselves a great disservice if we somehow think that Paul and the other apostles were superhumans, able to withstand anything without consequence. Well, I'm here to tell you today that Paul was just as human as you and I. And he experienced the same negative things that we do. Nowhere is that more clearly demonstrated than when he begins his 18-month stay in the city of Corinth. If you think he had an easy time in Corinth, I recommend that you go home and you read the two letters he had to write to that church. I mean, I believe Paul was discouraged despite having some early success in Corinth. And it led to the need for God to actually come in this passage and speak directly to Paul. Did you notice that? It was in verse 9. There's no other greater sign of our need for an intervention in our discouragement than the fact that God has to come and speak directly to us. For Paul writes later of his experience in Corinth, in one of his letters, the first letter he writes, he says this, "For I was with you in weakness and fear and trembling." He had a rough time. Here is what God said to Paul in our passage today in verse 9. "Don't be afraid. Speak out. Don't be silent. For I am with you and no one will harm you because many people here in this city belong to me." It's clear from that alone that Paul was feeling a bit beat up by life, that he needed God to intervene. And frankly, it is no wonder that Paul would feel discouraged. I want you to just think a minute about all the things he faced in that city of Corinth. Having just arrived from the city of Athens, which was the center of Greek culture and learning and religion, Paul makes his way alone, the 45 miles by foot to the city of Corinth. Paul is clearly lonely when he gets there. That is until God provides him two new friends, Aquila and Priscilla, two Jewish tent makers who were expelled from the city of Rome. They were expelled because the emperor decided that all the Jews in the city of Rome had to leave the city. But this particular relationship deepens, but Paul is still feeling very alone. He misses his traveling companions. No wonder he needed God to say to him, "I'm with you. Don't worry." The other contributor to Paul's discouragement has to do with the nature of the city itself. I was struggling a long time to try and come up with the best explanation of what Corinth was like in those days, and the best I could come up with is to say to you that Corinth in Paul's day was kind of like putting Wall Street and Las Vegas together in one. And you kind of get an idea what Corinth was like. It was commerce mixed with the pursuit of hedonistic pleasure. When Paul arrives in the city of Corinth, it had become a flourishing center of trade and commerce. Corinth was on, and Jim will love this because he was a geography teacher. Corinth was on an isthmus, I can't even say it right, between the Ionian and the Aegean Seas. And for ships to forego that long sea voyage around the land, boats in those days were dragged up on shore and dragged across the land to the other sea by horse or even by slave power. Thus to Corinth, men and ships came from all over the known Mediterranean world. And Corinth had lots of merchants. It had lots of money. And its main business was that of trade. That's the Wall Street part of the city. But Corinth was known for something else that tainted its reputation severely. It drew nefarious people from all over the Mediterranean, and that's the Vegas part. In Corinth, there was a massive temple to Aphrodite, who was the Greek goddess of sex and love. At its height of activity, which included Paul's day, over 1,000 temple prostitutes plied their trade in that temple. 1,000. And there were plenty of customers as sailors from all over the Mediterranean couldn't wait to get their shore leave in the city of Corinth. It's actually something I like what I read concerning the city of Bangkok, Thailand, where sex trade workers would find out when the American naval vessels would dock in Bangkok, and they would make sure that they were there to ply their trade. Corinth as a city was a hotbed of drunkenness and debauchery. This cesspool of immorality was made worse by the fact that people didn't see anything wrong with what they were doing. In fact, they thought it was part of their religious activity. It was sanctioned behavior. They believed that their debauchery was part of their religious duty, paying homage to Aphrodite. Visiting a temple prostitute in that day was as routine an act of religious service as we putting our offerings in the offering plate. That's how regular it was. This situation in Corinth, it devastated Paul. It wrecked him. Paul saw through the eyes of God what was going on in Corinth for what it truly was. He knew that eventually this pursuit of pleasure and material gain would lead to an emptiness in the hearts of people. Such worldly pursuits blinded people to their spiritual need, and Paul was frustrated at trying to reach the populace of the city. And even when people came to faith, it was very hard for them to leave their old lives behind. Just read Paul's two letters to the church and you can see the challenges that existed for that congregation. Perhaps you will remember one incident in particular. Do you remember the heated debate they had in Corinth over whether it was morally right or wrong for a Christian to eat meat that had been offered to idols as a sacrifice? That particular issue was tearing the church apart. The meat was very tempting for people because it was likely the only meat that most people would ever get in their diets. But would God appreciate one of his people eating something that had been offered to an idol? Clearly, being new to the faith, the conscience of the Christians at Corinth was getting unsettled. And just when you thought it was bad, it gets even worse. Rome, in its brilliant bureaucratic excellence, appointed a man named Gallio to be the governor of Achaia, which is the region that surrounds Corinth. This information actually helps us date with some accuracy when Paul was actually in Corinth, because Gallio was governor from 51 to 52 AD, so that's when Paul was there. It also means it's now been about 20 years since the church in Jerusalem was founded. Scholars have learned a little bit about this governor Gallio, and well, it's not flattering. He was not a mean governor, nor was he overly kind. Gallio was, in a word, simply indifferent. He didn't care about the issues of Corinth unless it was related to Roman rule or commerce or lining his own pockets. So indifferent to other concerns was this governor that the mob that grabbed Paul and dragged him before the governor and severely beat the temple or the synagogue leader did so right in the very heart of the courtroom. They didn't even go outside. They didn't even wait for an opportunity to get outside and do their damage. And the governor paid no heed at all. Didn't care. The Jews who hated Paul had misjudged Gallio. They thought he could be easily swayed to get rid of Paul. But religious matters, like Jewish law, had no value to the governor. He didn't care. Even before Paul could make his defense, Gallio dismisses the whole matter. Just get out of here. So we can see that in Corinth, Paul faced indifference, hostility, immorality, and loneliness. I can guess that at least once, Paul may have wondered why he was even there. I think in his heart he knew the answer, though. Yes, of course, God was the one who had sent him there, but think about why God sent him there. In Corinth, there lived some very sick people, spiritually speaking. Jesus, as we know, came to heal the sick. He came to save the lost, and there were lots of them in Corinth. Maybe this is the situation in Corinth. Maybe it's the situation in Corinth that inspired Paul when he wrote Romans 5:20. God's law was given so that all people could see how sinful they were. But as people sinned more and more, God's wonderful kindness became more abundant. We all need God's grace. But if there was ever a group that needed it more, it might be the people of Corinth. Paul knew that they needed Jesus, but he grew discouraged that he could ever make a difference in that city. So God steps in and commends him to stick it out. To stick it out because God had many followers in Corinth and many more would eventually come to faith. And the stakes were really high in that city. The further you are away from God, the more you need him. And the more you need God's servants to come and preach the gospel. Paul likely got discouraged because, well, he might have taken his eye off the bigger picture. Feeling oppressed, he found his vision was becoming focused on immediate events and circumstances before him. And that's what discouragement does to us. Discouragement keeps us from looking beyond ourselves to the grand plan God has for humanity. I ran across a story. I was wondering what Janet would do with this on the screen. I ran across a story that illustrates this very well. You might need a calculator or a pen to try and keep up, but here goes. And she's the math teacher. I should have had her do it. That's right. There was an Islamic man who died. And he left his 17 camels to be divided between his three sons. Got that? 17, three sons. Now try and follow this math. One son got 1/9 of the camels. One was to get 1/2, and the other was to get 1/3 of the camels. But as you can tell, 17 camels are not divided by 3 or even 2. Very difficult. The three brothers argued long and hard about how in the world they were going to divide the camels that way. And finally, in desperation, they went to a local wise man to see if he could settle it out and figure it out. They found him seated in front of his tent with his own camel staked out back behind his tent. And after listening to the case, the wise man got up, got his own camel, and added it to the 17. The confused three men wondered what he was doing until the man began to divide up the camels according to their late father's instructions. He gave 1/9 of the camels to the first son, and that's 2. Got it? He then gave 1/2 of the 18 camels to the next son, which is 9. And finally, he gave 1/3 or 6 camels to the third young man. You keep up on the math? 2 + 9 + 6 equals how many? 17. And then the wise man got his own camel back. What happened there? The brothers were so engrossed in this controversy that they failed to realize that their point of reference was too small. With the simple addition of an 18th camel, the solution presented itself. A wise man's momentary sacrifice of his own camel provided a solution for the brothers at no cost to himself. What we need from God is for him to enter our circumstance, widen our perspective, a perspective that is greater than our problems. I am positive that discouragement is stalking the hearts of people here today. I'm sure of it. It's a discouragement that might be crushing your vitality or stealing your joy or hampering your walk with Jesus. There are signs of it all around us in our world. You can see it in people's faces. You can hear it in their voices, and it clearly is demonstrated in our behavior. And so we hear a lot, "Oh, woe is me." Or, "If it weren't for bad luck, I'd have no luck at all." Or, "Nobody loves me, everybody hates me, I think I'll go and eat some worms." If we are grumpy, if we hold a grudge, if we are threatening to take our marbles and go home, then quite frankly, our vision is too small. If the extent of our communication with a brother or sister of Christ is to complain, then our vision is way too small. If we think our problems and our issues should take top priority in other people's lives, our vision is too small. If the only thing people say to our assessment of a situation is, would you like some cheese with your wine? Then our vision is too small. If what matters to us is our own comfort, our own happiness, our own recognition, our vision is way too small. Paul, you see, was in danger of becoming myopic, being nearsighted. It was a dangerous thing for him, and it didn't help the church one iota. Are we not always in danger of becoming myopic, nearsighted, you and I? God was saying to Paul, yeah, I know Corinth is an awful place. I know it's tough slugging to win people to me. I know you're tired. I know you're frustrated, but look, please, at the bigger picture. Have we faith to see beyond ourselves to the work that God's doing? Can we see the light shining in even the darkest places, like a city filled with temple prostitutes? Do we care about God's work even when men like Galileo are indifferent to it? Can we see the bigger picture through the struggles of our own daily existence? There was a couple who lived in London 130 years ago. Their names were William and Catherine Booth. They were a godly couple, but it seemed that William was in a real quandary, wondering what it was that God was calling him to do. At about that time, Catherine Booth was a noted Bible teacher, and she was invited to come and preach in London. While the couple were there, William took to having late night walks through the slums of London's East End. William noticed that at about every fifth building in that area was a pub, and that many of them actually had steps at their counters so children could actually climb up to the bar and order gin. The image devastated William. And then when he told Catherine, it devastated her. I seem to hear a voice sounding in my ears, said William. Where can you go and find such heathens as this? And where is there so great a need for our labor? Darling, I have found my destiny, he said. Later that year, 1865, that couple opened the Christian Mission in the London slums. Their life's vision to reach the down and outers that other Christian missions ignored. That simple vision of two people grew into the Salvation Army. Did you know that? Which is now ministering through 3 million members in 91 countries. This is the kind of vision God wants Paul to have in Corinth. And I truly believe that's the kind of vision God wants for you and I right here in Norfolk County.